Almost exactly a year today, on January 12, 2010, a devastating earthquake shook Haiti, its epicenter just 25 kilometers west of Port-au-Prince, the capital. A new report released by Oxfam indicates that a year later, less than 5% of the rubble has been cleared, only 15% of temporary housing that is needed has been built, and less than 45% of the $2.1 billion pledged for Haiti's reconstruction during last year's International Donor Conference has actually been dispersed. In November, international election monitors okayed an election that excluded Haiti's most popular political party. In November, also, Nepalese troops, part of the UN force, were accused of inadvertently bringing cholera to Haiti. At least 1,400 people have died to date of cholera, and many believe that not enough was done to prevent the epidemic. Today, on the Health Justice Radio Collective, we look at Haiti 1 year later.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi there, you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Nikki Bozanoff, and on the board is Eric Brown. Today we're going to hear audio first broadcast on CKUT 90.3 in Montreal by our friends at healthonearth.net. Here is Sasha Dick interviewing Dr. Megan Coffey, an infectious disease specialist who has been treating TB and cholera patients in Port-au-Prince since January 2010.
Dr. Coffey, we're so glad to have you here on the show. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about where you are and how you got there?
I've been working in Haiti since January. I've been working straight through. I came down with friends who run NGOs in Haiti, and they were working at Field Hospital and wanted me to come work here because I'm actually a doctor. When I got here, it was actually 2 weeks after the earthquake, so I was asked if I could work at the General Hospital, one of the main hospitals in Port-au-Prince, government hospital. And I to work as an infectious disease doctor. And I've been working here ever since. And what I've been mainly focusing on is being a tuberculosis doctor. So I have a ward of tuberculosis patients here. And I work alongside nurses who've been working here at the hospital for sometimes up to 25 years before. And so I continue to work every day.
As an infectious disease specialist, you're the perfect person to comment on the cholera situation. Can you tell us a bit about what you're seeing on the ground?
It's been an epidemic that's been spreading in various parts of the country, first starting in an area that's north of here, and a lot of rural areas that had largely been unaffected by the earthquake. And then it's spread kind of like wildfire in some places to small areas that a lot of times people don't have easy access to medical care because they live in such rural areas. I know a lot of people who've gone and worked in those places. I work at the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince where people can access care more easily. The mainstay of cholera treatment is actually very simple medicine. It's just that it needs to be done in bulk and very quickly. You need to just get people to get rehydrated and get as much fluid into them as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So all you need to do is make sure that they drink water with sugar and salt or that they have IVs if they need it, and they get IV fluids fast. So it's more oftentimes a logistical problem trying to make sure the entire country is covered. There's a lot of people working from the government, from a lot of organizations to make sure that happens.
I imagine this has the greatest burden on people who already have fragile health, the elderly, infants.
Yeah, particularly young children are at risk, and as well as pregnant women, because you really don't want to become very dehydrated when you're pregnant, and you can easily go into labor much earlier than you were supposed to. And then just anyone who can't easily access care, doesn't have access easily to clean water, and then just sugar and salt. And to make it clean water, all you need to do is boil your water or put a little bit of Clorox, a little bit of bleach in your water. Of course, the people who have the least resources who are the ones affected by that.
Mm-hmm. And so you have the resources in your hospital. It's just a matter of finding the people and getting them to the hospital.
I think for a lot of the country, which is not places where I work, but a lot of people live in areas that are remote, and it's difficult for a family to get their loved ones to the hospital because there just aren't. Ambulance, you can't call 911 here. So if someone's sick, it's the family's responsibility. to get them to care. So people basically wheel their family members in. In the city, if you call a tap-tap, which is one of the kind of colorful buses you see around the city, or you get a motorcycle, which is expensive for a lot of families. And if it's a family that didn't have clean water to begin with, that's an expense. And more so in rural areas where it's much further to get to care.
Very interesting. I know when we were setting up this interview, you said you didn't want to talk too much about the politics. But I wonder, in terms of health, do you find that there are people who are restricted in accessing care because of demonstrations in the streets? Or are you finding that there are more injuries because of those demonstrations?
Well, I would say that in general, people are cautious here. They know that when they often say the streets are hot today. So it would be a day that you'd be reluctant to go to the hospital. So pushes you not to go. There were times when there were just no cars on the street, and it would have been very difficult to get transport. You'd have to walk to get places, so a lot of the streets were blocked. So I'm sure there's people who delayed seeking care for any one of their medical problems because it was just so hard to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my nurses continued to work for almost 3 days because it was so hard for people to get from other parts of the city to relieve her, and she knew it was her job to make sure her patients were being cared for. So she continued working, waiting for all the rest of the staff to come back. And she obviously slept during that time, but that's a lot of work.
We have many nursing and medical students who listen to the show and who are interested, have a passion in international and global health. What would you tell them?
I think just becoming knowledgeable and reading as much as you can, following the news, trying to get a better picture of how health systems work in different countries. I think it's great to be able to volunteer. It's probably more difficult to volunteer right now, but I'm sure if there's ever opportunities to work even just in the logistics of cholera, especially if this epidemic ever spread further, to be able to work on just logistics and making sure the supplies are where they need to be can teach you a tremendous amount if you're a student trying to learn about how medical systems work.
It seems that there were some conflicting reports about the source of the cholera. We heard a lot here that it was coming from the Nepalese delegation. There was a French report, I think, that concluded that. But now the latest genetic testing would seem to just pin it down to South Asia in general. What have you heard?
Well, there's a lot of rumors that go around. I think there needs to be continued work on the genetic analysis to know precisely where it came from. So I don't want to add to any of the rumors. That's the best genetic analysis published so far, finding it to be not associated with more local strains of cholera, which is an important finding. But there can always be more research to figure out more precisely where the phylogenetics, where precisely the genes came from.
Absolutely. And for the record, you haven't treated any Nepalese for cholera.
I don't think I've ever met someone Nepalese in Haiti.
Very last question. We're always looking for signs of hope and strength because there's a lot of downer news in global health. Tell us perhaps some sources of inspiration or some hope that you see.
I would say my outpatient TB clinic. I have patients that come back full of health and chubby, who I met when they weighed less than 80 pounds, when they had to be on oxygen, and they were 16 years old. A lot of these patients look almost skeletal when they come in, because that's what TB and TB-HIV can do to you. It's amazing to see them get better. And the same is true. Cholera is actually something that, as a health professional, it's horrible that it's spreading. But when you see patients get better, you pour fluid into them, and they actually plump up, because they've often lost liters and liters of water. You put back that water weight, and you see those suddenly become healthy human beings again. You realize that you're really helping someone. And I know a lot of people feel they actually have really helped people that way. So I think there's always, when you're working in the health profession, you can always have the feeling that you've really made a difference, maybe just in one person's life, but it can be a lasting difference.
Hmm. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Coffey. We'll continue to follow your tweets. We'll link to them from our website and continue the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
That was our exciting interview with Dr. Megan Coffey. She can be found on Twitter at twitter.com Dr. Coffey, and we will link to that. Dr. is the Creole. We will link to that from our blog. We're going to jump right into our next interview, which is with Isabou Doucet, and we're going to take it away right now. I'm here with Isabeau Doucet, an independent freelance journalist who's been in Haiti for some time now.
5 months.
5 months, and you've been published all over, given interviews, and now we're very honored to have you back in Montreal and on the show, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'd love to get your perspective on the political situation there, since you've been looking at it closely. Pre-election, post-election, what's been happening with the various political positioning and the way that it has interacted with health or had an effect on health, or the way that health has affected the political situation itself. So let's start with the elections.
Okay, well, since I arrived in Haiti at the beginning of July, there were regular weekly demonstrations calling for the cancellation of the elections. Loads of IDPs were, you know, protesting in the streets saying we are not voting in this election from underneath our tarps. A lot of people were calling for the resignation of current President René Préval, because that's the only way they saw the possibility of having a free and fair, inclusive election. So basically, the CEP, which is the Provisional Electoral Council, is the board that decided which political parties could run in the election, and that was handpicked by Préval. And people knew, you know, when the election was decided, and that was and the CEP or KEP was selected, that this would never be an inclusive and fair election. Basically, it excluded a lot of different candidates, but especially the most popular political party in Haiti, the Famille Lavalas party. So, I mean, even just beside that, I think a lot of people are very disenchanted with the whole democratic process as it has been kind of imported into their country. People have tried, you know, as many, you know, a handful of times to have democratic elections, and when it does work out, they're government gets overthrown. So, you know, you could understand how there's a lot of cynicism, you know, to begin with, even just with this so-called democratic process that's funded and organized by foreign powers, this one being, you know, paid for by the United States government, the Canadian government, Europe, and the logistics and security being overseen by the MINUSTAH, which is the UN's kind of military peacekeeping troops there, who many people see as a kind of an occupying force that's kind of costing a huge amount of money and really not doing anything to look out for their own security. So there's a lot of problems with the MINUSTAH. I mean, they've been in the country since 2004. They were invited in under a post-coup government, which means that they were never, you know, the Haitian people never, like, voted or agreed to have them there. They were largely brought in to pacify, you know, the population. And, you know, it's an extremely expensive mission. A lot of people see them, you know, driving around in these very expensive, like, very muscular army kind of vehicles with huge guns, and really not doing very much in terms of, you know, this country that's, like, ravaged by this earthquake, and there's a huge amount of work to be done. They're not really, I mean, even in the aftermath of the earthquake, there was even, like, a kind of they were not allowed to get out of their vehicles for, like, the critical 72 hours that is needed to rescue people who are under the rubble. You know, they didn't do any of that. And what they did do was, you know, go after so-called looters, you know, and kind of there was this kind of climate. They contributed to this climate of fear, you know. So when the U.S. kind of took over the airport, already there was this kind of sense of, like, this is a dangerous place, which is completely bollocks. You know, I mean, excuse my language, but, like, I walk around Haiti all over Port-au-Prince at all hours of the day, and even in Cité Soleil alone, and, you know, it's not a dangerous place. Even historically, statistically, it's one of the countries in the Caribbean with the lowest crime rate. So there's a huge kind of
propaganda, as far as I'm concerned, to make it sound like a very dangerous place, which is very useful to, you know, justify the presence of the MINUSTAH peacekeeping troops or all these private security firms. But it's simply not true. And the UN's charter says that a peacekeeping force should be in place in a country where, you know, there's threat of civil war, or that it's threatening somehow international peace. And I mean, Haiti has neither a civil war. It's not at war with anyone. It's got nothing. It's got a lot of catastrophes, but it's certainly not a threat to any of its neighbors. So there's really no just legal justification for it to be there. The real question is, why are the conditions so ripe? With so much money having been thrown at that country, why does it still have the worst water and sanitation? And why are people so ready to, take that as an excuse to finally kick out the UN? I think that's what's more interesting. On the one hand, you know, there's very specific policies that prevented prevented Haiti from reforming its water and sanitation infrastructure. All throughout Aristide's term, he had big projects to kind of build a sewage and water sanitation infrastructure, and they were constantly blocked. The Inter-American Development Bank promised him like $56 million to rebuild the water and sanitation right around that region where the cholera broke out. And at the pressure of the U.S. government, which didn't want that amount of money going to the Aristide government, and also didn't want the Aristide government to have the to be able to take credit for, you know, taking on such a...
And we should clarify, this is a government that was deposed in 2004.
Yeah, that was deposed twice, last time being 2004, and then after the MINUSTAH troops were brought in. Anyhow, so in 2000, they blocked that funding, and despite that, continued to charge the government interest on those funds that were blocked for like 2 years. You know, it's just like, yeah. So I mean, I think that's like a very clear, you know, even more than the MINUSTAH, you know, like that's a very clear link, you know, for why cholera. I mean, it's not like if I got cholera or you got cholera, it's just like a cold. It's really not, you know,
easily treatable.
Yes. Exactly. But if you don't, I mean, if you need to get rehydrated and all you have is that same you know, foul water to get rehydrated, and you have no access to any kind of information as to how it spreads, or, you know, and Haitians, one thing I have to say that just impresses me so much, in every camp I've visited and in general on taps, these people are so clean. I mean, you just walk into camps and you see like these men like cleaning clothes, these women cleaning clothes. There's constantly people cleaning clothes. There's clothes hanging everywhere, you know, and in taps and crowded public transport in a very hot country. These people keep themselves really clean, I have to say. So, you know, it's a natural, you know, they can't control the fact that, you know, there's no sewage and sanitation. You know, it's just, it's a huge problem.
It sounds like, to sum up, because we are out of time, but it sounds like cholera is almost a symptom of the disease, which is power and jockeying for power and political position and money. The very outbreak could have been prevented if there had been investment in water sanitation, which there could have been, and then treatment, which is rather simple, was exacerbated or made more difficult because resources were put into running elections, even though the elections were being decried before they even started, basically.
Yeah.
And so now the health of the nation is suffering because of different factions jockeying for political power.
Yeah. I want to say another thing about that's interesting about cholera and the way in which NGOs, like I read a an email today about how, you know, people should, NGO workers should be very careful, even if this is an outbreak. You shouldn't just, like, go and put chlorine in the water, because there's all sorts of rumors now that, you know, people are poisoning the water with cholera, with the magic powder, blah, blah, blah. And NGOs, you know, considering that a lot of people pretty much, you know, it's, as far as anyone's concerned, MINUSTAH brought it in. And given that NGOs are sort of in a similar category, you know, them coming in and putting something in the water, you know, like, doesn't, it just shows how, like, you really need to sort of get to know the communities that you're operating in and, like, spend time explaining things to them. Because otherwise, you know, what are people supposed to think?
And
know?
Ideally, empower communities to do this for themselves, too, and make
exactly.
their own decisions. And the jockeying extends even to these NGOs, which are counting on foreign donors and trying to justify their existence, as you pointed out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So cholera can be used as a tool for them as well. So, cholera, a symptom of a political disease, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isabeau, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Any last words?
Well, just, I guess, if you did donate money to the earthquake, rather than, like, donating more money to cholera, like, call up those NGOs and charities and, you know, put pressure on them to figure out where exactly that money went, because in a lot of cases, there's a lot of very reputable NGOs that are still sitting on and collecting interests on, like, huge portions of the money they donated during the earthquake, and that now are going around doing another round of call-outs for cholera relief.
Even though they haven't distributed
exactly,
initial funds.
You know, some of them, you know, like, some of them, it's just, like, appalling, you know, from what I gather, like, maybe 20%, 25% of the money donated during to Haiti for the earthquake has been spent, you know. And I think also you have to ask yourself, why is the Canadian government, I think they only set up their first cholera treatment center maybe, like, a week and a half ago. I mean, this is a government that's, like, spending a lot of money on prison infrastructure and training of police, but not necessarily on, you know, making sure that there's, like, human rights and a properly functioning judicial system. I mean, it's not this, having police and prisons is really not the same thing as having a functional judicial system. And especially in a country like Haiti, where police have often been the ones perpetrating the violence, and where, you know, I mean, before, we don't, there's no proper statistics right now, but before the earthquake, there were about, like, 80% of people in prisons who had never been tried for anything, and who were in large majority political prisoners, supporters of Famille Lavalas. So I think it's, I really put a lot of responsibility and blame on the international community in this whole, you know, nightmare at the avant-garde of apocalypse that it's Haiti right now.
Okay. Well, Isabeau, thank you so much for coming out. Keep up the good work. We'll link to some of your articles online, and hopefully we can hear from you again soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. That was freelance journalist Isabeau Doucet giving us a very interesting perspective. She will be returning to Port-au-Prince soon. We now leave you with a short rap from a Haitian rapper in Creole. It is called Cholera.
κονδύλο gang. Μου σε νόλο τένι σου πλέσου πες να μου τέι. Yeah, μη τέξι μου πάβε πίσι κανού που πενέξ. Index, κιό του ζούγκα που νόγε σου δεν έξ. Και δεν τους είπα τα πέλη για βέκτη για βέτ. Πείτε τους κιό παγούνι στην που του λίγο τέξ. You, 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 yeah.
Okay, that was my good friend Sasha Dick from the Montreal show Health on Earth, and we were talking about Haiti 1 year after the earthquake. You can check out more about their show at healthonearth.net, and we'll link to them from our blog, healthjusticeradio.wordpress.com. Before we go, I want to give a quick shout out to all the hospitality workers who are striking at McMaster. You'll remember that our first show here at the Health Justice Radio Collective was about the increasing temporariness of the workforce and about the health impacts of precarious employment. So we encourage you to check that out if you want to know more about how the labor force is shifting and how these most vulnerable workers here at MAC are being affected. So we hope you'll support them. That's all we've got today on the Health Justice Radio Collective, 93.3 FM. I'm Nikki, and on the board was Eric Brown. Up next is French Toast.